This is the interview with Ernst Raymond on 26 August 76. And now we're talking with Henry Brown on 26 August 76 at Grenoble. So, can you tell me a little bit about your background before you actually got into radio astronomy?
Yes, well, originally I was in the original radar team that was at Bordsey Manor, that's to say Bordsey Research Station, and developed radar from...
I
joined it in August 1936, and I worked on radar, airborne radar, particularly night fighting and that sort of thing, until the end of the war.
Right, now this is different from the TRE group, right?
No, it was the thing that started TRE.
First of all
called Bordsey Research Station, and then you see it changed its name three or four times.
I see.
Till it finally ended up as TRE and then ended up as RRE.
Right, and just recently it's gotten changed to RSRE, you might be interested in, I found out.
After the war, I ran the navigation division there for a time, and then I joined Sir Robert Watson Watt as a partner. We ran a firm of consulting engineers in London on research. You know, Sir Robert Watson Watt was the pioneer of radar.
Right, and you were working with him.
I joined him to do the radar work for his firm, because, of course, I'd known him since 1936, and we had a firm in Westminster.
I see.
And, after we'd been running for about 2 years doing consulting engineering, he decided he wanted to go to Canada. So I didn't want to go to Canada with the firm, so I wrote to my friend DuBridge, who was the president of Caltech,
right,
and tried to get a job there, and he said I had to wait a year, so I went to Manchester and to get a job in the electrical engineering department. And Professor Williams there, professor of electrical engineering, said, well, why don't you go out and see Professor Lovell?
Uh-huh.
Who's out at Jodrell Bank. So I went out to see him because I knew him during the war. He was with us on radar.
Right.
And he had a big antenna there, 218-foot paraboloid, which they'd built for cosmic ray detection by radar. And this experiment hadn't been done because it had been shown that there was some... initial mistake in the theory of the calculations or something, but they had this beautiful 218-foot dish, and he suggested that we should apply it to radio astronomy. And
now,
so
when was this? What year is this?
This is in 1949.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and so I went to join him. And
before you go on now with the work at Jodrell, can we go a little bit through the sort of things that you worked on in the radar? Because I am interested in how people's experiences in radar influenced what they did in radio astronomy, whether techniques were taken over and this sort of thing.
Oh, yes. Development of receivers, development
right.
of transmitters, development of modulators, display circuits, and antennas particularly, the whole thing from scratch. We started radar with an sort of empty room, more or less. We had to develop our own alternators for high-frequency power supply, our own cathode ray tubes had to be made, the vibration in aircraft, almost anything you can think of.
So you were involved in the whole...
The whole thing. In the development of circuit technique,
mm-hmm.
you know, pulse technique for circuitry, for driving displays and time bases and modulators.
Right.
All this had to be done from scratch.
Now, in these considerations, did cosmic noise, Jansky and Reber's work ever come
no,
into...
No, no, we read Reber's paper in 1940 when it came out in the IRE and said that's very interesting, but no, it didn't come out.
Yeah.
I mean, the only way in which radio astronomy impinged on radar at all was much later in the day when there was some observations of solar noise by Hay, you know.
Right. And you knew about that, of course, when this report came around, I suspect.
Yes,
but it didn't...
Yes.
It didn't really operationally affect how the radar was developed.
No, no, I was interested in... I was in the original team that developed airborne radar for night fighters and also the detection of submarines. In fact, I did with Dr. Bowen the first flight radar detection submarine myself.
I see.
1939 in Gosport.
Hmm.
But so, you see, we had a wide experience of modern high-frequency technique and circuit technique. And, of course, that is where people like Ryle and so on learnt their radio.
Right. Oh, yes.
Ryle was with us at the TRE later on, and he was later on and so on.
Right. Well, he just told me last week about how what a fantastic education that was.
Yes, it was.
It's a hard way to do it, but nevertheless,
well, we had the
one knew what could be done, and you took the responsibility at a very young age of tremendous systems.
Well, we had the very good... There was only one other laboratory which was comparable... and that was the EMI laboratory at Hayes in London, and they'd been developed television, and they had Blumlein there, who was a genius, and their technique was ahead of most people's. It was ahead of ours in many ways, especially in circuit technique.
Uh-huh.
But we drew on their experience through contracts, research contracts.
Now, after the war, not everyone could go into this fledgling thing called cosmic noise or whatever. Did you consider it at all? Or
no. No, I didn't, no. I wanted a job in electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I was a consulting engineer immediately after the war, but when I gave up the consulting engineering and looked for something else to do, I wanted to go straight into electrical engineering work. I would have done work on antennas.
Now, did you follow it at all, sort of reading Nature during those 4 years after the war when you were in it?
No.
So this was all brand new to you when you went out to Lovell site and...
Well, yes, except I spent the... Yes, it was brand new, that's right. It was only brand new in as much as I'd read Reaver's paper. I knew that. And that was all.
Right. Okay, well, so I gather then that you liked what you saw and hired on.
Yes, I joined him in August 1949, and the problem was to apply this existing 220-foot reflector to radio astronomy. And this involved really doing the whole thing. In other words, putting in a decent feeder system. I bought a coaxial cable from the BBC, putting in a decent stabilized receiver, where we copied the technique partly of Ryle and von Berg, developed at Cambridge, and we built our own stabilized power packs and so on, and the whole thing was to make the receiver sensitive and stable. And, and I did this, and we started surveying the sky with this instrument, and we went on for several years doing it.
Well, surveying the sky is easy to say, but you had to pick out something to specialize in.
It's an extremely difficult operation, because in point of fact, this instrument was not designed to have a steerable beam. The mast, 125-foot mast in the middle, had 18 guy ropes, and in order to change the direction of the beam, you had, in fact, to manipulate 18 guy ropes and tilt the steel mast over.
Right, so you did not do it...
two theodolites and two people. But the first one of the first experiments I did was to map the radiation from the galaxy and radio stars in the galactic plane and that sort of thing, and then decided that I would like to see whether or not the Andromeda Nebula, which was the nearest galaxy similar to our own, also radiated radio emission, whether radio emission was in fact a peculiarity of our galaxy or whether it occurred in other galaxies.
Right.
And that was the origin of that paper.
I see.
So what we did was we took the model of the Andromeda Nebula and said, if this behaves in the same way as the Earth, as our own galaxy, not the Earth, if it behaves in the same way as our own galaxy, then we should get a certain signal from it. And that was the origin of that experiment. And it was the first extragalactic source, really, that was done.
Right. But now, this earlier work that you mentioned where you mapped the plane, was I don't think that was published, was it?
Yes, there are some papers in
well, at least it was
Survey of the Cygnus Region, Survey of Cassiopeia Region.
Oh, I see. That was published, though, after the
Radio Stars.
The M31 Nature
Yes, it
paper.
Was published later on.
But
it took a long time,
you
see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what you found in Andromeda, was it surprising at all, or...?
No, not really. It did more or less what we expected it to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where were you learning your astronomy at this stage, though? Because this was all an entirely new ballgame, was it?
Oh, yes, right, yes. Well, as a matter of fact, the early radio astronomers really didn't know enough astronomy. They didn't usually take enough trouble to learn the astronomy, as a matter of fact. But, we just read it in books, that's all. And that was all there was to it.
So this is where you learned about things like the Andromeda Nebula and so forth?
Sure, yeah. Oh, yes.
Well, okay. Now, Hazard was, I guess, the junior...
He's a student.
He was a student
He joined me as a postgraduate student, yeah.
And you and he did a long series of papers together on...
Yes, he worked with me for a long time, yes. Yes, we did radio models, theoretical models of the galaxy. We did surveys with this thing. We did work on radio stars. We detected things like the supernova remnant in... I can't remember which one it is now. Cygnus Loop, I think. No,
I know what you mean.
No, one of the supernova remnants. Tycho Brahe, I think. And that was suggested in a lecture by Kopal, actually. Kopal was giving his lectures on astronomy, and He in fact suggested that we might look at supernova remnants, and so we looked at the first one that we could get in the field of view of the 220-foot dish.
Was that a useful source of knowledge, so to speak, astronomical knowledge, with the Manchester Astronomy Department?
Yes, Kopal was very useful. Kopal used to come out once a week and give lectures at Jodrell Bank on astronomy.
I see.
And I think this was a very useful, solid background, too, to taught some of our people astronomy.
Hmm. How long did this continue?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. He went on for some time. I can't remember now.
Hmm.
A few years, I think. I don't remember now.
Well, along these same lines, I see a reference here to a report of an RAS meeting in October 51 in an observatory in which you describe your survey of the Cygnus region at 1.9 meters. So it's clear that here you're talking to the astronomers and feeling. Did you feel a part of the astronomical community at that time more than the radio ionosphere community or some such?
Well, I suppose so, yes. But in point of fact, the linkages with astronomy were not all that good, I don't think myself. It took some time for... You see, if you look, for example, at the international situation, nearly all the work on radio astronomy went on in Commission 5 of IRSI.
Right.
It didn't go on in the IAU. In fact, I was secretary of Commission 5 for several years. And it went on there because the emphasis was always really on the instrumentation, you see, not on the astronomy. In fact, a lot of the astronomy was rather naive, really, but the problem was to get to develop the instruments.
Right.
And it only gradually switched from the emphasis being on the instruments to the emphasis being on the astronomy. And it's a process which went on very slowly, and you can see how the center of gravity of the international interest, for example, shifted from IRSI to IAU. In corresponding to this change in emphasis.
Where would you say that the sort of was the halfway point in this
transitional
changeover?
I don't really know. I suppose somewhere between 1955 and 1960, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the hydrogen line work produced was a thing which produced quite a change in that direction towards concentration on astronomy. Because there you had a full-blooded observatory, that's to say the Leiden Observatory,
right.
Where you had radio astronomers and astronomers working in collaboration,
mm-hmm.
and the other radio astronomers associated with electrical engineering departments and physics departments realized they simply didn't know astronomy like these people did in Holland.
That's right.
And that had a very powerful effect.
That's a very interesting comment, because as you know, there's a tremendous difference in the philosophy of how the radio astronomy is done.
Yes.
It still is.
Yes.
In terms of the engineers being very distinct from the astronomers.
Yes.
They're sort of the servants, not in the pejorative sense, but they work for the astronomers.
Yes. But in those days, of course, it was almost the other way around. In other words, the king was the technical man, the man who understood the machinery.
he was indispensable, and he still is, but still there was no doubt about who was running the show in Leiden.
In Leiden, certainly. Yeah. That's always been true in Leiden, but not in England.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah.
The difference between the Dutch philosophy of the astronomer decides on some astronomical thing of interest, and he then hires an engineer who can take care of the problems of making a receiver and, you know, these technical details.
But on the other hand, I mean, I don't necessarily say that one is better than the other, because what theoretical astronomers and astronomers tend to forget is that all the major steps forward in their science are not the result of theory. They're not the result of an observation being thought of. They're the result of a new instrument. I mean, right the way from Galileo's first use of a telescope to the development of spectroscopy in the 19th century, which, 19th century, was in fact astronomy. And that's what revolutionized astronomy. And then the radio telescope, and then the spectrometer, the hydrogen line spectrometer, and all these things. You see, they're instruments which haven't been then applied to a problem.
Yeah.
And the astronomers don't, you mustn't let the situation arise in which the astronomers are allowed to dominate the scene.
Right.
Now, I can illustrate you that very nicely, actually, because when I was at Jodrell Bank 1 year, I was instrumental in getting a man called McGee, an Australian called McGee, to come up and lecture on image intensifiers. And he had developed, he was an expert who was with EMI originally, and he was working at some university in Imperial College, I think, and he developed this image intensifier. And he gave us the story of it, and he wanted to apply it to astronomy. And I said to him at the end of the lecture, well, what telescopes have you applied it to? And he said, I've never seen a large telescope in my life. Okay. Now, I said, well, why don't you take it down to Hospenshoel or somewhere like that and apply it there? And, of course, the answer is that the astronomers in those days used to say, we don't want all this complicated electronic equipment in the dome at night. It's unreliable. We don't know how to work it. And anyhow, we're perfectly happy using existing spectroscopes. And that's an actual fact.
Yeah.
The astronomers resisted the introduction of the image intensifier. Whatever they may say now, that is actually true. Because I know. I tried to get the image intensifier, in fact. Experimentally tried in England. Yeah. And it would have probably shortened the time for its development in England by 5 years if the astronomers had welcomed it.
And this is not confined to England, I don't think, this attitude either.
No, I take always a very strong view over this, because I went to a meeting in Cambridge not many years ago on the instrumentation for the 150-inch telescope, at which Fred Hoyle drew diagrams on the board, in which he started with theory and said theory results in observation results in development of instruments and so on, and drew this flow diagram, and of course... there was Felgit and myself there. We were both absolutely infuriated by this. To point it out, this wasn't true at all. I mean, theory does not, in fact, initiate new developments in the subject. Yeah. It's new instruments that do it. And that is why radio astronomy has been so... Oh, the other thing, too, about astronomy, optical astronomy, is classically speaking, it's been conducted on high mountains and observatories, which are rather cut off from interaction with physics departments and electrical engineering departments. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the advantages radio astronomy has was it could be practiced in places which are easy to get at.
Right.
And Jodrell Bank, in fact, was associated quite reasonably well with a university.
Right. In Cambridge also.
Yes, this is where the vitalities come from, to a large extent, from the actual instrumental push in the subject.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there could be any argument on that in radio astronomy. I think...
No, but you see, optical astronomy suffered from the fact that there wasn't this instrumental push.
But I can think of perhaps a counterexample. I mean, Copernicus, here's a person with a theory.
Yeah.
Who then, I don't know whether one could say that really pushed an observer to go out and try to prove the theory or not, but that was not based on a new technique or anything. That was a new concept.
Yes, that's true.
But I think, in terms of what we're talking about, 20th century astronomy, that everything you say is...
I mean, you can look at Leo, and you can look at the history of Leo and the coronagraph, or you could look at Lallemand or something, and, these people were pushing the astronomers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and the radio astronomers, I think, are pushing the astronomers in the 60s. I mean,
Yes, well, of course, they've imitated them. I mean, they have provided the stimulus to them. Yes, that's right.
Which brings up the general area, I guess that's what I began with, the relationship between... When you talked at an RAS meeting in 1951, was it sort of just polite attention you received? Here's the radio engineers, and they've got some new signals, or do they really consider you as colleagues?
There were one or two people who were very... most of the people would not regard it as very important, but there were people, long-sighted people, rather Catholic sort of tastes in science, who would understand the impression. Now, I tell you a very good example of that, and that would have been Oort, of course.
Right.
Jan Oort, I mean, he took an interest in the thing right at the beginning.
Right. Any other examples?
Oh, I'm not sure that I can think of it much right off. No, I'm not sure. No.
Well, Bart Bach has had a very strong interest from the very beginning.
Yes.
Jesse Greenstein.
But I agree with that. Although it would tend to illustrate, the history of the Harvard Observatory would tend to illustrate something which I was talking about, which is that there the astronomy was too much in the driver's seat. The technical side was not strongly enough represented in the early history of the Harvard Agassiz Observatory.
Yeah.
It's very true that in the early stages of any science, you must be fully aware of the limitations of your equipment, and those boys weren't, and they made some horrible mistakes.
Yeah. Well, I guess the same thing could have easily happened at Leiden if it just weren't for Mueller. I mean, you had that
Leiden just happened to have the right people.
Right.
Yeah. That was a very happy combination. And
well, on the technical side, I don't think it's a matter of people. I think it's just plain Mueller.
I agree with that.
Virtually.
I regard one of the weaknesses of the British system, for example, of radio astronomy, the history of radio astronomy, as the failure to develop effective liaison with its optical side. Now, I did, in fact, try to do something about this from time to time, and, in fact, later on in the time, Woolley once tried to persuade me actually to go there and start a radio astronomy section at Hurston's.
I see.
And I turned it down on the grounds that I thought that there were two major optical astronomy observatories in England, one at Jodrell Bank and one at Cambridge, and there was a minor thing at Malvern or something. But my view was that you couldn't spread the money around too widely, and so I didn't do it. But in point of fact, I don't think that was a wise decision, really, in many ways. I mean, the radio astronomers and the optical astronomers didn't collaborate as they should have done in England. Right. I mean, Dewhurst, for example, at Cambridge, started off some quite fruitful identification work of radio stars early on in the piece. Right. In fact, I think he probably found the first man to identify the nebulosity with Cassiopeia. Why in God's name didn't he push it on? Yeah. Why didn't he start from there and go on?
Well, I just talked with him last week.
I mean, you want to ask him that. I mean, what does he say?
Well, you're in Cambridge with a 36-inch, the only good telescopes are in the side of the world.
That's just it, of course. The answer is that, of course, what we did was we you know, that was just it. I mean, you're in Cambridge with 36-inch and, 35 nights a year or something. So what you do is you write to the Americans and say, look, for God's sake, look at this place in the sky. And that's what happened.
Right.
And, in fact, the optical collaboration came, of course, from America. It was Minkowski and Bader and so on, the people we
really played. What you're saying is it needed an aggressive personality who would have set up a British telescope
Do this, or what should have happened is a British astronomer should have taken up optical identification early on in the piece and carried on. And I mean, if he didn't have a telescope in Cambridge, then he should have damn well gone to Haute-Provence or America.
Well, Dewhurst did, in fact, finally go in the late 50s, but there was a several-year gap in there.
Yeah, he missed a big opportunity, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah.
But now...
It's unkind to say that, actually.
Well, I mean...
I think it's true.
You mentioned that Woolley was interested in possibly setting up a radio section, but this
At one time, yes.
Yeah, this seems to be rather opposite to the reluctance to take on electronics for optical astronomy.
Well, he finally understood that electronics was vital to modern astronomy. He was converted in the end. Completely converted.
I see.
He was converted by some work that was done by, Boxenberg, I think, among other people.
But this is in the 59?
Late in the piece. I can't remember exactly what date now.
This is getting into the 60s, I think.
We're getting into the 60s now,
Okay.
Prior to that, there was very considerable resistance to anything electronic in the dome, I can tell you.
So when you talk about this radio group, about when was that date? Was this after you'd gone to Australia?
That offer?
Yes.
Oh, that was before I went to Australia.
That's what I was thinking, okay.
Right. That must have been in 1961, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Going back to specific science points, you have an article in Monthly Notices in 51 with Hazard on Cygnus A, giving its position flux and something about the fluctuations and so forth.
Mm.
What were you thinking at that time? I guess you didn't have the optical identification then.